Welcome back to Legal Moves. I'm here with the second part of my interview with Jamie Stegmeier, Ben Rossett, and Matthew O'Malley. Why don't you introduce yourselves real quick? Jamie.
I am the president of Stonemeyer Games, publishers of Viticulture, Euphoria, and the upcoming Between Two Cities.
Very cool. Ben.
My name is Ben Rossett. I'm the designer of Between Two Cities from Stonemeyer, also brew crafters from Dice Hate Me Games, Marcy's Mechanics from Nevermore Games. And I also am in the game industry full-time now as a project manager with Panda Game Manufacturing.
Very cool. And Matthew.
Hi, I am Matthew O'Malley, game designer of A Princess Bride, The Battle of Wits from Game Salute, Diner from Dice Hate Me Games, Not Dice from Black Oak Games, and Between Two Cities from Stonemeyer Games.
Very cool. Is it a coincidence that you both have a Dice Hate Me game coming out, or no? Yes, a coincidence.
I think so. I think it's a coincidence. That was developed completely separately, not.
Okay. So last episode, we got up to where the Kickstarter campaign had begun. I guess this first question is for Jamie. So you're sort of known as a Kickstarter guru, right? Do you feel any pressure to perform well or to run the Kickstarter campaign perfectly, given the fact that, you know, you're sort of an authority in that area?
Well, in particular for Between Two Cities, yeah, I felt a different type of pressure because it was the first time I'd run a campaign. I was running the campaign for Stonemeyer Games, but I was running it for a game not designed by me.
Right.
And I wanted to do it justice. I wanted Ben and Matthew's game to get the attention, support and funding that it deserves. So yeah, I felt a different type of pressure there. Absolutely.
Okay. And did it perform to your expectations, or do you have, how do you manage expectations before and after a campaign?
Yeah, there are a couple of different levels of that. So the first is something that we hinted at the last podcast, like the expectations for responsibilities. What's my responsibility during a project compared to the responsibility of Ben and Matthew.
Right.
This was something that I think we actually may have started to discuss way back when we created the contract between Stonemeyer Games and Ben and Matthew for Between Two Cities. And Zach, we didn't mention this on the previous podcast, but you were the lawyer that kind of put together the contract for us.
You
helped us out with that.
You
contract.
Added me. Yep.
Yeah. So, did you want to speak at all to that process and the type of things that you ask publishers and designers to think about when they're aligning those expectations, particularly with Kickstarter?
Absolutely. So, one of the big things that I tell clients is you want to be as specific as possible upfront before you sign the contract. And there's a few reasons for that. First of all, you know, of course, everyone, when they get together to write to start a business venture together, they're always friends, right? You want to be friendly, but the lawyer has to think of down the road, what if you end up hating each other, or what if the project doesn't work out? So what happens then? And so having realistic expectations about what everyone's roles are and what their specific tasks are is very important. And it's a good discussion to have up front, because if you don't discuss it and you don't put it in the contract, then these are surprises that are going to crop up. Like, suppose that Jamie expected Ben and Matt to be extremely active during the Kickstarter, but they have full-time jobs and they're designing other games, and maybe they can't. The reason they go with Jamie in their minds is because Jamie's going to handle the Kickstarter. So when you sort of hash that stuff out, and I'm not going to talk to specifics about what, you sort of did. When you hash that out beforehand and you get it written down in the contract, everyone can understand it and have an open discussion about it before you enter into the business deal, which is always better. So you don't want to go into it hiding things from the other side. It's never good business, and it's never good lawyering if I were to let you do that. I know that we discussed some things like convention appearances and other responsibilities, right? And so
right.
Do you feel like that was important, Jamie, to get that out in the open beforehand? I mean, does my reasoning resonate with you? Do you think that's
Yeah, I think it was really helpful for the Kickstarter, and you mentioned the conventions. We mm-hmm. recently went to Gen Con, and Matthew, actually, this is a great example, because Ben and Matthew are very different roles at the convention. Ben was there to work for Panda, for Panda, the company that he works full-time for.
Right.
Matthew was there. And so Ben dropped by, he said hi, hung out a little bit, but that was his main intent for being there.
Right.
And so we didn't pay for Ben to be at the convention. Matthew, on the other hand, was there to teach people how to play Between Two Cities, really. And so he was there in a very Stillmeyer Games capacity. And so we covered all of the expenses for Matthew to be there. That was our responsibility. And I know I'm getting probably a little too specific there, but that was something that came up in the contract and was probably good that we had up front. So Ben and Matthew didn't have to worry about that. And that way they can make a decision. Matthew can make a decision. Does he want to go to Gen Con as an attendee, or does he want to go as a representative of Between Two Cities?
Right. Another issue that usually comes up in these kind of agreements is dealing with Kickstarter funds versus non-Kickstarter funds and ongoing sales and how long you get to publish it. I mean, there's so many issues that could come up. Again, it's important to define what happens with the Kickstarter proceeds and, you know, how much goes to each of the designers, if anything, how you're deriving the amount of money that's coming from each sale of the game and what royalty percentage or what upfront fee, all of that stuff. So all that stuff needs to be discussed beforehand and shouldn't be left to figure out after the contract is signed and the game is published, because that's how you get into big disputes. And, you know, the board game industry is no stranger to disputes. It's not as big as other industries. So, you know, you're not going to get as the high profile cases like in the movie industry or even the video game industry. But, you know, we still have we have strong personalities and we have big companies and all of those things get together to cause problems. So
I would say, though, from a designer perspective, I think it's also important to have some expectations for what you're going to see in a contract. I remember the first time when I got into negotiating contract for my first game, I did my homework, right? Like I read as much as I could online, and talked to as many people, designers that were already published that I knew that I was friends with, publishers that I knew that I was friends with, about what should I expect to see in this contract that I'm about to get and what is fair in the board game industry, and you know what should my expectations be for this contract, and what are the things that absolutely need to be in that contract, and so I feel like I had a pretty good idea about that ahead of time, and that helps a lot. So if you have some expectations, if you have some kind of deal breakers where, you know, these three things must be in the contract and these three things must not be in the contract, that's a really good place to start, I think, as a designer. So, you know, whether you hire a lawyer or not, and definitely put in a plug for Zach, I think, you know, you're great and very affordable. But if, you know, even if you don't, as a designer, have some expectations about what that contract should look like when you receive it. And that's a great place to start.
Right. One of the questions I ask people is, just sort of give me what do you want out of the contract before I even start telling them what they want out of the contract or explaining different things. I just want to know just what's their gut feeling, or if they have experience, you know, where are there some things that you specifically want that you have in mind? Because often those are the whatever comes from your heart is going to be the important things. And that's the things that we're going to make sure that either get negotiated and get written down in the contract. All right, let's get back to the Kickstarter campaign. So is there anything that you would have changed about how you ran it or promoted it or anything about it? I'm sure you've written postmortems on your own site, Jamie, but maybe you could reiterate those things here.
Yes. Yeah. I went back and looked at some of the entries I wrote before we had this discussion. I think that I'm pretty pleased with how the campaign went. I always, like I said, I wanted to do as best as it possibly could for Ben and Matthew. So I'm always looking at ways that I could have improved it. And the three little things that I highlighted on my site in the postmortem were that, there were some little things about the stretch goals that probably could have been a little better. And I won't go into the details of it, but the thing that I learned from it is that I did a thing with Between Two Cities where I didn't reveal, I revealed the stretch goals kind of one by one. I didn't reveal them all up front. Or at least on the first day, I didn't reveal them all. I think maybe on day two, I put them all up there, but not on day one. And when I was getting feedback before we launched from my ambassadors about the preview page, I showed them what the project page would look like on day one with only one of the stretch goals. And so they didn't see all the other stretch goals.
Okay.
And so they weren't able to offer me feedback on them. So I learned that if I'm going to use that technique in the future, that I should show all the preview volunteers who are offering their feedback, I should show them all the stuff so that they can give me their feedback on all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I can remove it if I want to. That way I have the feedback in place and I'm not caught off guard. It's kind of an obvious thing, but I didn't realize it.
Had you not done that in previous campaigns?
Previous campaigns, I had revealed all the tools up front, and so they were all on there for the previous things.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Go on. It's okay.
So I was going to move on to a different mistake that I made.
Okay. Well, then, question. All right. So my question is.
Such a long list, Jamie.
long list of screw ups. Oh my, yeah. So, Jamie, are you strictly in the stretch goals are good camp, or have you? I mean, there's definitely a minority attitude out there that you know no stretch goals is the way to go, and people are anti stretch goals. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I've had some good discussions about that with Grant Rodiek, who recently had a great campaign for Focus. He didn't have any stretch goals. I would say I'm firmly in the camp that stretch goals, when done properly, can benefit a project and mm-hmm. can build a lot of backer enthusiasm. I ran a poll a while ago about a backer poll asking them what are the reasons that you would back a project now instead of waiting for the retail version? Mm-hmm. And the number one reason, I think, above everything else, was that they liked having the ability to make the product better, not just for them, but for everyone.
Right.
And stretch goals have that. That's what stretch goals do. That's what they are.
Right.
So I kind of like giving the backers, in general, I like giving them what they want, what they have fun with.
Well, that's the whole point of crowdfunding, isn't it? You give them something that they want, and they will pay you for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben and Matthew, do you have any issues with stretch goals or an opinion on using stretch goals and how it affects the design process? Cause this is one of those things where in some cases people will add new cards or new mechanics to a game as part of the stretch goals. How do you feel about that, Matthew?
Right. Well, I'm completely in Jamie's camp. When it comes to stretch goals, I don't think that the stretch goals should be something that are necessary to enjoy the game. And I don't think that they should have any mechanical impact on the game, like new cards that alter something.
Right.
So I think that Jamie's stretch goals for the art or for improvements in components or something like that are fantastic. And that I took his advice, as well when I was doing my own Kickstarter for Not Dice. So, that's.
Oh, Ben, maybe you have a unique perspective on stretch goals since you help with project management with the manufacturer. So do you have any advice for how to structure stretch goals and put them budget-wise and just monetary goal-wise?
That's exactly what I was thinking. I'd love to provide that perspective. I think as a publisher, I think stretch goals are great. I think you should use them on your project, definitely. As a publisher, you should absolutely know the effect that they are going to have on your bottom line and on your costs. So you are thinking about running a Kickstarter campaign and you're said, well, I want to have stretch goals and I think these are the five things I'm going to add into the game. You should know before you start that Kickstarter campaign exactly how your costs are going to change when you add those five things into the game. You should already have that priced out and be part of your financial picture. The worst thing I think you can do probably from a publisher, and you know we've seen this at Panda, is to add something into the game because the Kickstarter backers are asking for it. And they say, well, we really want this fancy meeple, or we really want this, or we really want that. And the publisher kind of breaks down and says, okay, if we reach this stretch goal, we'll add it. And then they do, and then they have no idea how much that thing that they just promised they're going to put in the game is going to cost,
right.
And that might really derail their financial picture and put them in a lot of trouble. So be absolutely sure about what you think your stretch goals are going to be before you start the campaign. I think what Jamie said, getting some input from your backers along the way is great, as long as you are able to retain that final control and be able to say, no, we can't add that into the game because it would make the game cost an extra $20. We can't do that. So just kind of have a plan for your stretch goals ahead of time. If you do it that way, I think that you'll be safe as a publisher. And I'm speaking kind of from a manufacturing cost perspective. Mm-hmm. But as a consumer, you know, I love stretch goals. I think they're great. I think we should absolutely have them. I think it gives people more of a reason to be involved in the Kickstarter campaign, because if you just put a game up there and say, this is the game, and this is the same game that it's going to be on the retail version in 6 months, well, I don't know if I need to get excited for that Kickstarter campaign. I'll just wait 6 months and I'll go pick it up at my game store. So yeah, I definitely think stretch goals are good, as a designer, as a, you know, in all facets. Just be smart about what you're adding into the game and knowing exactly how that affects your game.
Oh, Ben, as a...
I can piggyback... Sorry.
Jamie, please. No, that's okay.
Could I have one other thing there? Because Ben, I think, touched upon something really important and something maybe designers don't realize when they're adding on this stuff. Like Ben gave the example of adding on an extra meeple or custom meeple. And sometimes that custom meeple may not actually cost that much to add. But, and the meeple isn't even a good example here, but sometimes like it might impact how deep the box has to be. So suddenly you have a whole different, you've moved the entire shape of the game into a different size box, and your designer has to redo the box. If you have to get bigger art for the box will no longer fit into like a certain type of shipping container, or it's heavier. Right. So sometimes those little changes that maybe don't add that much cost can have a much bigger unseen impact on the game. And that's where someone like Ben at Panda can help you figure that out before you make that promise to backers.
Right. The butterfly effect, right?
Right, exactly.
So Ben, your role at Panda is a project manager. My understanding of that, I think from one of the panels Jamie was on at Gen Con, where they had a couple people from Panda, not you, Ben. As the project manager, you're sort of working on things after they've started manufacture. Correct. And then there are other guys that sort of handle things with quotes and getting publishers to understand what the cost would be beforehand. Right. Or do you deal with both sides of things?
More often than not, I start getting involved at the point where a contract is signed. So let's say that somebody runs a successful Kickstarter campaign. They're a first time publisher. Hopefully they've already gotten their quote from Panda. Hopefully they already know how much the game is going to cost ahead of time to produce before they run their Kickstarter campaign, which is another no-no that we see all the time.
Wow.
So hopefully they already know and they've already gotten a quote and they're already working with an account manager at Panda. And then their game funds. They know what stretch goals they've added. They know how many games they're going to need to produce based on how many backers they had. And then at that point, the game will kind of get handed off to someone, to a project manager at Panda, someone like me, and we will take them from that point all the way through the manufacturing process until the point where they receive their, you know, 3,000 copies of the game or whatever, wherever they want it to be shipped. So that entire manufacturing process is kind of covered by project management.
Okay. Last week I had JT from the Game Crafter on and Andrew Tulson from Print and Play Games. Do you guys make use of those services during your, before your Kickstarter campaigns, during, while you're prototyping? I guess, Matthew, let's talk to you first.
I think this would be primarily for Jamie, okay. But we did use Print and Play Games to put together some copies of Between Two Cities for the playtesting process.
Okay.
I think also some review copies. Is that right, Jamie?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a reason why you would select Print and Play Games over Game Crafter? Not that they're not both excellent, but one of the questions I asked them when I interviewed them last time was, you know, what differentiates the two of you? How do you stand out from the competition? And I think one thing that Print and Play Games said, or Andrew said, was that they have a quick turnaround and that they allow for more custom parts. Was that a consideration?
Okay, so Between Two Cities We really, I think, could have gone with either of them, but I had worked with Andrew before. And I guess in just like Matthew actually made the process much easier than it could have been because Matthew, I don't know, Matthew, you don't call yourself a graphic designer, but you have many graphic design skills. And so Matthew was very good at laying out the files for Between Two Cities at a time when our graphic designer was, I think, in somewhere in South America. She was up on a mountain somewhere.
It sounds like me.
But in general, I like print and play because I can't do that stuff that Matthew and my graphic designer can do. But Andrew's very helpful. Where I can send them some files and say, I just need these cards. Can you figure it out? I'll pay you whatever it's worth and just take care of it. And he'll do that. Like it's an email to Andrew and he does it.
Okay.
Which is really helpful for me.
Yeah. The both of those businesses seem very personal. Like you talk to a guy and actually that's how it sounds that like Panda is as well, where you're talking to a person and someone's sort of with you all the way. That's a very cool part of the board game industry. I think that, you know, it's made of people and, you know, they're not sort of real high up. You can call and get answers when you're the designer.
Right.
So Matthew, do you think that it's important for designers to have maybe not a graphic design experience, but just an understanding of the tools like using InDesign or Photoshop, those kind of software programs?
I don't think that designers need to necessarily have knowledge of those particular tools. I think that it's very important for them to have a concept of graphic design and layout and communicating information to players.
Okay.
Because that can make a huge difference in a play test. You may have a game that will work quite well and very smoothly if the graphic design is all there. But if you just don't have it laid out well, or if every single thing that could be an icon is now a word, that makes it very difficult to play. But as far as using a specific graphic design tool, I don't think that's a requirement for a designer.
Yeah. Do you find it's useful to sort of distill the game art down to its simplest form so that when people are playtesting it, when you don't have final art, it's better for them to understand the game?
Yes. But I also think that sometimes people can get into the feel of the game a little bit more if there's a little something that makes it feel more like a final version of the game instead of just white paper.
Okay.
What do you
guys use as far as prototyping art? That's sort of a discussion because if you're just grabbing images from Google Images, you know, technically it's probably copyright infringement. It may be a de minimis. That's what they call it when it's just so small that it doesn't matter. But if you're grabbing it and you're putting it up as a print and play PDF, then you have problems because you're distributing this copyrighted material. I know that there's sites where they have, I think it's gameicons.net and some other things, and there's lots of public domain images. Do you go that route or do you create your own artwork? How does that work?
So I use all public domain images.
Okay.
And this is something where Ben and I differ, not in using public domain images or whatever, but I generally jump into putting lots of icons and art and stuff on a design far too early.
Mm-hmm.
Ben really prefers holding off on that and trying to get something to play faster so we can realize, hey, this really doesn't work. There's no reason to invest more time on this.
Right.
But Ben, do you want to talk about that any?
Sure. Yeah. I see as a designer, I mean, I'm not a artist. I think I have decent graphic design skills. Just as a gamer, I know what should be used as a displayed as an icon, what should be text. So I think I'm decent at graphic design. Matthew's definitely better, and I'm definitely not a graphic designer. But yeah, I mean, I just use pretty simple programs. I actually just mostly use Microsoft Publisher and Microsoft Visio to do a lot of my own cards and boards and stuff at home.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to hold off on having to buy and learn the Adobe Creative Suite. Although I just bought a Mac, I'm switching from Windows to Mac, and I realize I'm going to lose Microsoft Publisher and Visio, so I'm kind of freaking out about that a little bit. figure out what I'm going to do. But Yeah, you know, I do use a lot of Google Images. I hope that's not going to land me in some legal troubles after we'll talk about
probably
that. But
no one listens to this podcast, don't worry.
for my own prototyping stuff, of course, nothing that I'm putting out as printer player stuff, just to grab images. But yeah, Matthew and I talk about that too. And I see designers, a lot of time, new designers that have these really sleek looking, you know, prototypes, card games, whatever, that they've printed from print and play productions or from Game Crafter. And I really don't do that. Actually, the first time that we ever paid for any kind of, that I was ever part of a project that paid for any kind of prototyping was when we did that, those copies of Between Two Cities with print and play. I've never done that. I just do everything on my home computer. My general rule of thumb to other designers is that your game has to look serious enough that a publisher knows you care about it. Okay. If you're showing a publisher something that's written on index cards or trying to play test that, people are just really not going to respect that because it doesn't look like you put any time into it. So you don't have to have final art. You don't have to have, you know, perfect, great cardstock. You can just get this cardstock that they sell at Staples and grab some Google Images. And as long as it looks like you care about it, that should be good enough as a designer. Also, I don't understand why people pay a lot of money for prototypes, for early prototypes from print and play productions and Game Crafter when things are going to change. Like, oh, I came up with this game design idea and I paid $50 to have a print and play productions copy of it. And now I'm going to play test it and find out that, you know, 80% of the card's abilities need to change anyway. So I don't understand why you just spent $50 on that. But I guess that's just a kind of a personal thing. I like to wait to invest a lot of time into graphic design and into art and in resources until the game is in a much more stable state.
I agree. And I think it's a common problem, especially with in this industry where it's their first time, especially if they're first time designers, you know, they want to put their best foot forward. They want to look professional even, and by spending all that time and money up front, where I think from the publisher side, and maybe Jamie, you could speak to this, that's not really what matters, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think both Matthew and Ben have touched upon the important thing that does matter, which is that the game is playable and that, actually this is something I ran into at Gen Con, because we saw a lot of prototypes and it did seem like more and more designers were focusing on having kind of bare bones, but functional prototypes, which was great. But, and Matthew kind of pointed this out, there were too many prototypes that had a lot of text on them instead of icons. And so I think that's one gap where, like, I don't need professional icons. I don't need final icons at all. But a little icon here and there can help out a lot when you're looking at, like, 20 cards on the table, all of which have their own text boxes.
Right.
So that little UI element can make a big difference when I'm seeing a game for the first time.
So let's talk about the reactions at Gen Con. So people played it in your room, Jamie. What was the feedback you got from it?
Matthew can probably speak to this the best because he was running the vast majority of the playtest and the teaching sessions. But so I kind of saw the after effects of that and the glow from people as they walked away having a great experience. And there were a number of times where I heard Matthew say, "All right, guys, we're wrapped up, but we have a half hour left. You guys want to stay and play another game?" And I think almost every time, unless people had something to rush off to, they were there for the full hour. They wanted to play as much as possible.
Excellent. Yeah, my table had similar reactions where everyone was very happy with it and said that they surprisingly enjoyed it. I don't know what it, maybe it's sort of an unassuming looking game, right? But then when you play it, it's really fun. So it's not flashy, right? It doesn't have a bunch of miniatures or whatever, but it's very good. I love it. I'm not one that gets excited a lot, so this is my golden review. You were playtesting expansions there at Gen Con. When did you start thinking about putting an expansion in, and when does work on the expansion usually begin?
I think it's something as a designer that you kind of naturally think about. If you think that you have something that's going to be catchy and you think that you have something that's going to be success, you naturally think about expansions, during the design process, even of the base game. I think that something should definitely be a full, you know, and complete game. I've never as a designer intentionally held something back from what I otherwise think should go into a base game just because I want to hold it for an expansion or anything like that. And Matthew and I talk about this a lot. We talk about expansions. And my philosophy right now, whether it's right or wrong, is kind of we'll figure that out when the time comes. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in making the best game that we can make right now. And then if it warrants an expansion, if it does well, we'll figure that out. We'll make an expansion for it. So I think there are some things you can do to kind of plan for that a little bit in terms of like manufacturing and component costs and things. But, the bottom line is if the game's not good enough to warrant an expansion, there aren't going to be any expansions. So I think that you should put more of your effort as a designer into making a good game in the first place that is going to warrant expansions in the future.
It's a bit like making an expensive prototype for a game that's not great, right? You're thinking way too far ahead rather than getting the core of it correct.
I think so. And maybe I don't think far ahead enough as a designer. I don't know. I'm sure that I will learn more as I continue to design. But I think that I usually am not so worried about what's going to happen down the road with an expansion. You know, I say, well, we'll kind of figure that out when it's time to figure that out. Matthew might have a slightly different perspective, though, so I want to turn it over to him.
Yeah. So also, in addition to everything Ben said, a lot of ideas that might turn into expansion ideas are ideas that just come up during the design of the game. So while we were designing it, like Ben said, we were in the last episode, we were spending months trying to figure out what to do with adding these four additional tiles into the game to turn it into a square. And so most of those ideas we just threw out, but it's possible that some of those ideas are going to come back. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things, some of the things that did turn into our expansion, our 1900 expansion for Between Two Cities, are ideas that we had while we were designing the basic game, but we knew they didn't really belong just in the game,
right,
as it was. I don't know if we want to mention any more about the expansion itself or
sure. I mean, when you think of an expansion, maybe give your theory of what makes a good expansion. Because I know personally, and I think I said this to you, Matthew, when I played the expansion, I'm not generally a fan of expansions. I think a lot of times I play one and I think, you know, there was really no reason for this. It just sort of makes the game more complicated. I don't know. But what do you think from a game design perspective, what makes a good expansion and why? You know, why bother? Why would you want to do an expansion for a game that's at its core already great?
Right. I think there are a couple of different reasons behind it. Primarily, from the design perspective, it's a way to explore some more ideas in basically the same structure, in the same world. So it can be that players want to spend a little bit more time in this world that you've created. Mm-hmm. And they are just interested in seeing different things that can happen. One of the, I forget who this was, but someone commented that, some designer commented that the first expansion on a game should be essentially more of the same. It shouldn't introduce a whole lot of brand new stuff, because the reason that people want an expansion is because they really liked what the game was,
right,
and they want to do more of that. And then if you end up doing additional expansions, then you might add in a bunch of different things. But I think there are plenty of games that stand fine on their own, mm-hmm, and perhaps shouldn't be made more complicated. But if someone wants to get the expansion for it and play a more complicated version of that game, I think that's also fine. And, you know, anyone who just likes the base game doesn't need to get the expansion.
Okay. I'm wrong. I get it. No, what I liked about the 1900 expansion that I played was that it just sort of picks up where the game, the base game ends and continues with the theme you're building up. And, you know, I don't know if how much you want to reveal about it, but it's I thought it was very good. The ideas and thematically, I think it works well. So congratulations. Mm-hmm. You have my approval.
All right.
Yep. Ben, how much of a hand did you have in creating this expansion? And Jamie, I guess.
Well, myself, very, very little. And Matthew really took the lead on the 1900 expansion. Mm-hmm. And as he said, I think in the previous podcast, we kind of split up the work a little bit. Like we have two ideas. Okay, you go off and work on this for a while. I'll go off and work on this for a while. And we'll bring it back. And Matthew definitely was the one that went off and worked on the 1900 expansion. So I give credit to him. It's mostly him, and it works well. We definitely, I think, you know, going to continue to play test it and do some more development on it. But most of that was Matthew. I think to answer your earlier question as a consumer, mm-hmm. you know, what do I like in expansions? And really, you know, I have a lot of expansions for games, and the ones that I like are the ones where I refuse to play the game without the expansion.
Right.
Right. So those are the expansions really that are worthwhile. Does it make the game better? Is it now a better game? And do I not want to play the base game because I feel like I'm missing part of the experience?
Right.
And yeah, and for those are the truly
excellent ones.
For a lot of games that I love, even for like Agricola, which is one of my favorite games, you know, I have the Farmers of the Moor expansion and I like it, but I don't refuse to play Agricola without the Farmers of the Moor expansion. I don't think that it makes the game that much better than it was.
Okay.
So that's really what it is for me. And I think as a designer, that's what I'll kind of try to focus on as well.
Jamie, as a publisher and a designer, how do you feel about expansions and when it's appropriate and what sort of expansions are appropriate?
I agree with most of the things that Ben and Matthew have said. I do think it depends on the game a little bit. I think Between Two Skews is somewhat unique because the base game is so short. You know, it's a 20-minute game, which gives you the potential to add something else that makes the game a little longer if you want to keep playing it and continue building upon, like you said, in the 1900 expansion, you just keep building on the thing that you've already built. Whereas, I designed and published an expansion for Viticulture called Tuscany that's really 12 different expansions. Like, I kind of put everything into one box. It kind of, I guess, bucked the typical model of publishing one expansion at a time because I wanted more of a legacy experience of adding right. a lot of different stuff to the game in a different order. As you guys were saying, those requirements, I was kind of checking them off for some of those expansions and not checking, like I would say that some of those expansions are not necessary and not everyone fits with them every time. So as we look towards future versions of Tuscany, we'll probably cut out some of the stuff that isn't seen as required and other stuff that we see as required. But also from a publisher perspective, expansions I think can bring a game back into the public spotlight
right.
when a game maybe gone out of people's attention for a little while. So I think an expansion can really help reinvigorate a game that maybe people have let gather some dust on their shelf for a little while.
When you kickstart the expansion, do you generally sell the base game with it as one of the reward tiers?
You know, that's something I've debated a lot. I don't know. Because I did that for Viticulture and Tuscany, but it was just part of it was because there was a collector's edition option where you could get both of them at once. And another part was that we kind of aligned the print runs for the second edition of Viticulture for Tuscany. The danger that I have found that I don't really know what to do about it, because I think a lot of people do go to the Kickstarter and they want to get both because they heard good things about the base game and that was their chance to get both and ship them both together. But the danger that I found is that more and more people are asking me, like for Euphoria, we're playing a Euphoria expansion, and people are often saying to me, they say to me, like, I'll wait to get the game until the Kickstarter. And I don't want them to wait. Like, the game is available right now. I want them to just buy it now. And I don't want to do that to retailers either. Like, I want the retailers to do well with the games that we publish. So I don't want them to wait.
Right.
And so I may go out of my way on the next game, maybe before Euphoria, to not have it as part of the Kickstarter. So people know that that isn't like an industry standard. They don't have to wait for the expansion Kickstarter to get the base game that they can buy right now in their store today.
Okay. Now, so this is a legal podcast, sort of. So let's talk about what kind of other legal moves you guys made during this process. We talked about contracts earlier, but, well, actually, I guess a question for you, Jamie, is, so before you enter into the Kickstarter, do you generally have contracts in place with your graphic designer and your artists and other people? Because, I mean, you know, one part of the having a Kickstarter is you have to have all this beautiful art and really to sell the game. So do you take care of all that beforehand, or do you have people on staff that are doing that?
It's a little mix of the two. Like we mentioned, for Ben and Matthew, the designers of the game, we definitely had a contract. My graphic designer kind of works for me on an ongoing basis. Contract work, but ongoing. Like she only does freelance for us in addition to her full-time job. So we don't really do – you can actually speak to this after I say it, but – we have the level of trust where she just knows that I'm going to pay her for all of her work at the rate that she asked me to pay her. And like that expectation is out there. Usually I guess the things that we talk about up front are timing. Because the timing, the schedule is what's really important, not the money side with her. Mm-hmm. And I had that relationship with a few artists, but always when I work with someone for the first time, I definitely have a contract. And regardless of anyone I work with, I definitely get those expectations out in the open, even if it's not an official contract.
Right.
Does your lawyer red flag jump up when you hear that?
Whenever there's not a contract in place or something, I of course. But, you know, sometimes reality trumps, you know, paying a lawyer. And there's a lot of cases where it's someone's first game or their first Kickstarter, and they just don't have the money to pay a lawyer up front or to get beautiful art. And so there have to be other ways, whether you're, I mean, I would always say, like, let's say you can't afford to hire a bunch of people, but you want to bring people on as partners. I still think you should be getting some sort of an agreement between the two or three or however many of you. And when you have a bunch of people with different skill sets, sometimes it's good to be partnered up with them to create a game. I don't know. What about trademarks and copyrights, that kind of stuff? Is that something that you're concerned with, Jamie, or even Matthew and Ben?
Hey, Matthew did not dice. Matthew, did you do a trademark search for not dice?
I did a search. I did not do any sort of trademarking or anything.
Okay.
It's something that I will look into. but I don't know. I sort of feel... I guess this is where I'm still looking at things more from the game designer's perspective than from the publisher's perspective. And I probably need to think about it from the publisher's perspective as well. But from the designer's perspective, the mechanics of a game can't be copyrighted or whatever. So it's more a question of just show everybody your games and hope that a lot of people enjoy it.
Right. Well, I mean, from my perspective, there are a lot of reasons to do those things. I mean, a copyright is actually not too expensive. You know, if you hire a lawyer to do it, it'll be more expensive, but there are advantages. And actually, I think I'll do a little mini episode after this to release sort of halfway through the week that will just sort of explain the copyright and trademark benefits of registering. Mm-hmm. Because with both of them, just by using them or by creating something, you get copyright rights technically and trademark rights, right? Your trademark comes from using the trademark in commerce. The problem is if you don't register them, you can't actually do anything with it. So that's what I'll talk about in them. So if you're subscribing to this podcast, just to keep an eye out for a midweek episode.
All right. I'll listen to that.
Yes. Or I'll write about it on my blog. So I think we can wrap this up. I really appreciate you guys coming on. This was a great two episodes. So thank you to my guests, Ben Rossett.
Thank you, Matt.
I'm reading my show notes incorrectly, which is, I feel like a moron because I'm just thanking people. So thanks again to my guests, Ben Rossett, Matthew O'Malley, and Jamie Stegmaier. Where can our listeners find you, Matthew?
I am at Twitter at Black Oak Games and also blackoakgames.com.
Cool. Ben, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Ben Rosset. My last name is R-O-S-S-E-T. You can also find me as the director of WashingCon, which is a new game convention that I'm helping to start in Washington, D.C., washingcon.com.
Very cool. And Jamie, where can we find you?
You can find me, you can find my Kickstarter stuff at kickstarterlessons.com. You can find my company stuff at Stillmeyer Games, either on Twitter, Facebook, or stillmeyergames.com. And I'm at Jamie Stegmeyer everywhere as well.
Jamie, this episode will be airing right before your book comes out, so why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. I have a book about crowdfunding called A Crowdfunder's Strategy Guide that will come out on September 14th. So we're just about a month away from that release now.
But this won't be going out for 3 weeks, so this will be a week away. Yes.
Perfect. Yeah.
All right. Awesome. So everyone go to Amazon. Search for Jamie Stegmeyer. I already pre-ordered my copy. All right. So you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com, and you can check out my contract creation site for game developers at indiegenerator.com. If you use the coupon code IndieGen50OFF, you get 50% off any contracts you generate for the rest of 2015. Also, make sure you review us on iTunes. Those reviews really help, and we still don't have any. So please, if you're listening to this and you enjoy the show, please review it on iTunes. And I will see you on the next episode of Legal Moves.